Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and thank you for listening to Idle Chatter. I'm Ray Bohax, the Hot Rod Farmer, coming to you from Hackettstown, New Jersey, and I hope that today is finding things going well on your operation. So it is, we're into July now, at the nice 4th of July, 5th of July here in the Bohax farm. Historically, that is our day or my day to pressure wash my house, and much to the enjoyment of my wife. And this past year, with all the moisture we had, it got kind of dirty, but we pressure wash it at least once a year, and I had the opportunity to use my new pressure washer. We used to call them power washers, but I guess they're really pressure washers, that I bought last year. And it is the second time, or I should say the second time I use it to do the house. And I love that machine. I'm so tired of this big box store junk. And I bought a steel brand that's actually made by Mighty M in Iowa and has a Kohler engine. And it's got a horizontal shaft motor on it, or engine on it. Probably the motor is electric, but we call it a motor, even though it's really an engine. And that thing is just sweet. It doesn't vibrate. It doesn't move. And the thing is a beast. And I just love it. So, there's nothing, because there are wonderful joys. The good Lord gives us many joys in life. But to a machinery guy like me, an engine guy, a hot rod farmer, or a mechanical guy, there's a great pleasure found in operating high quality American made precision equipment that just does what it's supposed to do and has very little NVH, noise, vibration, and harshness. I did a show on that a couple of weeks ago, and just it's a real pleasure when things work as they should and to the highest level of as they should. And that is how my steel RB400 pressure washer is. So enjoy doing that. And hopefully you guys had a wonderful 4th of July and you had a safe time and you were able to balance some field work with celebrating America and the salute to America, and the 7 flyovers that President Trump had was just great. It just it doesn't take much to fill my heart with joy of being an American, just seeing the flag flying, but that event really just brought tears to my eyes, and it's wonderful to be able to acknowledge the blessings that we have as Americans and the sacrifice that others have made so that we may have these blessings. So hopefully your crops are doing well. I know, once again, it's a mixed bag. We couldn't be farmers without talking about our crops. And my last planting is up and at 'em, thank God. And it's, you know, really, it, if anything, this year proved a lot of things to me. And it really proved to me how you could have the same field and just different, as I've always said, in different weather conditions in the same field because you've planted at different dates. And it looks like two different fields, it looks like two different hybrids, it looks like two different planters put it in the ground, and it could not be more varied. And my last plantings, which is in another field that had a lot of cover crop residue on it because I couldn't get it burned off in time because I broke the sprayer, as you all know. So that is coming up beautifully, and I have to say that my planter did a beautiful job, thank God, of singulation. And and covering the crop with all that trash. I do not have row cleaners, so it didn't have the opportunity to move it away. And so that Shoup no-till culter and that double disc opener did a great job with that, thank God. And I'm very, very happy. My first four plantings, it's like, let's not talk about it. And then my last five plantings, I'm quite happy with, except where I messed up the rows and went cockeyed and could not see because I could not see my row markers because of all the trash on the field. But the planter performance was phenomenal. And the singulation of the precision planting meters was phenomenal. And the Copperhead Ag furrow cruiser closing wheels did a great job. And it was just weather conditions, so that made the other ones not that much of a joy. But ironically, my first planting in the field that is my disaster field actually looks quite good. So it is what it is. We trust in the Lord, but it really, really drove home to me. I mean, it's something that I, obviously as farmers, we all knew that the weather conditions make a huge difference, but I really, really brought that home, and I have to make a new game plan for next year, as we all have to do sometimes, right? Sometimes the game plan is to just keep the same game plan. And that's really what I'm going to be talking about today in a roundabout way, but it's really nothing to do with planting corn. What it has to do with is eradicating electrical gremlins. And electrical gremlins could be a real nightmare because they have no rhyme or reason to them. Like, I've had problems with my computer, as you know, last week and the week before, blowing up. And it has no rhyme or reason to it. And oftentimes you can't apply conventional wisdom to what you are seeing. And the and how I'm making that analogous is that to my farm this year is because it's the same seed, the same planter. The two fields that I planted have basically almost carbon copy soil structure, the CEC, amount of organic matter, so they're basically almost carbon copy fields. You could almost Xerox the soil test for each field and just rename it, made no difference. And just the idea of the weather conditions made me second guess. Well, I was blaming myself, I was blaming the seed, I was blaming the planter, but really it was just the weather conditions. And why I'm bringing that up is that, you know, when you're dealing with electrical gremlins in a system, whether it's on any type of vehicle, farm machinery, what have you, is that it often causes you to go in the wrong direction, second guess yourself. And though I was even saying with my crop, I was saying to my wife, well, geez, maybe we should plant a different hybrid for the first planting, so this one seems to be a prima donna. And I was inventing a science for my failure. And my failure was basically the field conditions were not right, and that was it. And I was, and you know, that's one of the things that you could easily get caught astray, and that's why we're going to be discussing electrical gremlins today, and to take a I don't want to say a scientific, but a educated approach to eliminating them or identifying them and fixing the problem. But I also want to give a shout out to Casey Seymour. I was blessed and honored. He does an excellent podcast on the Global Ag Network called the Moving Iron Podcast, and he deals with the business side of farm equipment, where I deal with the mechanical side. And Casey does a great show. He's out there in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, which is an area that I'm quite enamored with. I love that particular part of the country, western Nebraska, the panhandle into Wyoming and the Dakotas, and it's quite majestic and quite beautiful. And coming as a New Jersey farm boy, which New Jersey is the most populated state in the nation, just seeing that vastness, and it's just unbelievable. But I was blessed to be on Casey's show, and if you have never listened to his show, I would suggest that you put it on your podcast list, and he could be found on the Global Ag Network, and his show is the Moving Iron Podcast, has to do with the equipment side of business. And they often say, your success on the farm is a three-legged stool. It's a grind. agronomy, it's marketing, and then if you're in animal agriculture, obviously animal husbandry, and it's also the equipment side. And then the equipment side breaks into two categories. It breaks into what I'm doing about the technical aspect, the maintenance, the repair, understanding how it works. But there's the business side of that equipment, because first you have to buy it, finance it, pay for it, or do whatever. So they really go hand in hand. So I want to, and if Casey is listening, I want to thank you so much for having me on your show. It was a great experience, and I truly enjoyed it, and I was blessed by it. And I hope that the audience enjoys it also. But the other thing I wanted to talk to you about, real quickly, getting back to my crop, and I only tell you this because I know that as a farmer, we learn from each other, and that's really what my show, Idle Chatter, and my Farm Machinery Digest website are all about. It's education and learning from one another, and oftentimes, you know, you glean something from someone, and you could listen to them for, like an hour, like listening to me for an hour, right? And, you know, if you glean one thing out of my hour talk, then I will feel that my time making that show that week was successful. And even if you just in casual conversation talk with another farmer or someone else, and then you glean one or two items, or like I say, if you glean one thing in your net, then I think that that's great, and that's what life is all about. But, you know, what had happened was that I was able to see firsthand the value of the fertility recommendation as far as my broadcast spreading is concerned, that Ben and Tim Hushin from the mill where I get my agro-liquid fertilizer from had recommended. And I could see when I was putting down my broadcast, which was 20 gallons per acre of agro-liquid high-energy N, 10 gallons per acre of 32% N, and then the agro-liquid C-Tech carbon-based product. But when I broke the sprayer, I lost all of that, but I did do some rows with it, and then because I couldn't go down to Maryland to get it back at Bend, and I need to get my crop in the field, my GrowMark dealer does not carry agro liquid, and he doesn't carry 32%, and he carries 30% in. So I spoke to Tim down in the mill, and I said to him what had happened. I said, what do I need to do? Do I need to change this rate? And he said, well, what I would suggest is if it's going to be 30% and no high energy N, go up to 35 gallons per acre instead of 30, which would be 20 high energy N and 10 of straight 32% N. And so I did that for the remaining part of the field. And, you know, the blessing of this is that, you know, when you break stuff and stuff like this happens and things go astray, if you learn from it, it's not a disaster. It's an investment that you made for an education. And so, like I said, I made an investment where I had life put an investment on many of us to truly understand and what soil conditions do to crop germination and also emergence and yield and what have you. And I also was able to see firsthand that the rows of corn that were planted on the same day that were treated with the broadcast of the high energy N, the agro liquid high energy N product, 20 gallons per acre, and the 10 gallons of 32% N look better than the rows that were planted the same day that have just the straight 35 gallons per acre, 30% N. Let me get my numbers straight. So it was really interesting, and I want to take my hat off and thank the guys over at the mill over in Maryland for recommending that, because I'm not saying that the other corn looks bad, by no means. The other corn looks good, but the one with the high energy end and with the C-Tech carbon definitely looks better. It's actually a little bit, it's planted the same day within 15 minutes of one another, and the corn is a little bit taller, it's a little bit stouter, it's a little bit greener. I mean, if I was to take a picture of the one, and it does not, I don't want you to think it looks bad, it doesn't, but the other one definitely looks better. So that is great data from a bad experience, right? So that is what we are going to talk about, the electrical gremlins. But, you know, on that same note of getting data, I once again want to tell you, and I'm driving this home every week because I feel that it's very important that if you could get there, that it would be a plus to your business, and it will be an asset. And if you take away one thing from that, from going to the Agro Expo, which is August 13th and 14th in St. John's, Michigan, And that is a very, very special and educational field day. And you will be able to go there and see trials like I had in my field that I didn't want, all right? But you'll be able to see trials with different fertility. You'll be able to see different fungicides, different applications of things, and just be able to come and walk through the grounds and have knowledgeable people. And, you know, that's the whole thing that I really want to drive home. And I've been telling you this for a couple of weeks now because, you know, I'm a firm believer in the Agro Expo. And if I were not a firm believer in the Agro Expo, believe me, I would not compromise my integrity and try to drive this point home to you. But, you know, going someplace and having, you know, you could see the crops in front, you could go a lot of places and see that. But, you know, what are the comparisons? And the most important thing is to have knowledgeable people that do not have an agenda explain to you what's going on. And, I mean, sure, I mean, if I go to the auto show and go to press day at the auto show, as I said before, is that I'm going to talk to the Ford guy, then the engineer is going to tell me about his product. He's not going to tell me about a Toyota, all right? But the thing basically is that he's coming there as an engineer, not as a salesperson. And that is what is so great about the Agro Expo, is because it's a technical conference where you could come and you could look at different fertility programs, I'm hounding on fertility, but every aspect of it, and different crop management practices, and see not what a guy with a salesman's hat on. And please, you know, I understand people have to make a living, and I never knock that. And, you know, hey, I'm hoping that you listen to my show, so everybody in life is a salesman per se, but it's where your heart is, where your motive is. And at the Agro Expo, their motive is what my motive is that we're in lockstep together, we're of the same cloth, we're cut from the same cloth, we're of the same ilk. Their goal, their desire, is to make the American farmer and rancher, no matter what part of agriculture you're in, truly profitable and to help them. And that is why the event is so educational and not a sales presentation. Because these guys will tell you, hey, this is what we have in here. It's better than what we did. And, you know, and that's what I like. But also, you're talking to people that have such a passion for agriculture. And when you talk to them and you listen to them and they show you what they have going on, the passion just comes out of them. And that's really something that brings of great value. And hopefully you do have a chance to go. And if you do get there, please, please look up Troy Bancroft and his sons, all right, because they are hot rod farmers. They're farmers, they're car guys, they're tractor guys, they got hot rods. Troy's got his first new car, is 77 Olds 442. I believe he dated his wife in that, but don't hold me to it. All right, they have they're hot rod farmers. They're hot rod farmers. They're good Christian people. And I think, so if you do get there, ask for Troy. You could ask for his son, Nick. You could ask for his son, Albert. And you could ask anybody around there. Say, the guy from New Jersey said to go see these hot rod farmers. And they definitely are. So listen, the Agro Expo, August 13th and 14th, St. John's, Michigan. And be there, or as I used to say in the old days, be there or be square. But I'm going to modify that and say be there and learn and take that back to your farm operation, your ranching operation, and then use that to be more profitable. You know, and just use that education, convert that education into profitability on your farm. So now, getting to the subject matter at hand, right, which I'm sure you're all anxious for, is that, there's as I said with my field and using that as a metaphor for electrical gremlins, it is very easy to blame the wrong things. And oftentimes in life, when we're diagnosing anything, and there's so much in common with a crop failure, which I consider my first three plantings, three out of my first four plantings of being a crop failure. And even there is some seed there and some plants there, but there's more weeds now, which I have to take care of. But anyway, so the dangerous territory, for having some sort of electrical problem or a mechanical problem in a piece of equipment, an engine, what have you, but specifically electrical problem, is to go down the wrong path, to blame the wrong thing, to invent the science or what you think you see, and also to just throw parts at it. Now, believe it or not, when it comes to some things, the diagnostic procedure is basically, the specified diagnostic procedure is to replace with a known good part. And that is a diagnostic protocol, but that is not the first step. So it would be just like that. The first step is that if you see something, you see a problem in your field with your crop, right, you don't go mow it down and replant. You try to determine what's going on. Is there nutrient deficiency? Can I put a foliar product on there? Can I do a side dress? What have you? You don't just throw out the baby with the bathwater. So many times, specifically with electrical diagnostics, all right, is that the person goes from it not working to let's go to town and buy some parts and put them in there. And in the auto business and in the machinery business, we call that throwing a parts store at it or throwing a parts department. Now, let's keep changing stuff until something works. And oftentimes, you change a lot of things and it still doesn't work. All right, so that is not the first step. Just replace it. The first step is to try to determine what is going on. And also, as I've said before in this show, about being a diagnostician, oftentimes a diagnostician is, your purpose is to determine what is good instead of what is bad and or failed. So if we look back at it, is that if we look at crops and we do a tissue test, where some guys now are also doing a tissue test and a sap test. I have not done a sap test yet, but the thing is that if you look at it, because there'll be a lot of diseases, for instance, like in corn, Russian diseases, nutrient deficiencies, that almost present the same way and almost look the same way. So I think boron and possibly sulfur, don't hold me to it, I may be wrong about that, but I know that there's an overlap, and lots of times you'd look at a corn plant or a soybean plant, what have you, and it's hard for you to truly, you say, it could be boron, it could be this, it could be that, and that's why you do either a tissue test, or you do a sap test, you do a soil test around that plant, and see what's going on. Because shooting from the hip, most of the time, you miss the target, right? And the same thing happens with diagnostics, is that you need to determine what is correct, and then through process of elimination, if you determine what is correct, the end result will bring clarity to what is not correct, or in this particular instance, what has failed or what is wrong. So, and if you use that mindset, now, it will get you what we would call the critical path. It'll get you onto the critical path to proper diagnostics much quicker, much sooner, and without spending a lot of money and riding back and forth to town, right? So I'm going to go through some steps here, but the first thing you need to do is you need to have the proper mindset. And the proper mindset is we have to try to determine what is going on. And just like you could look at a plant and you could see the end result of a nutrient deficiency, you cannot actually see the nutrient deficiency. You see its end result. And the same thing is when you're trying to deal with electrical gremlins. And why I'm called it electrical gremlins is because, you know, that will come and go. The proper term would be intermittent electrical issues. That will come and go, because when something is working fine, it is almost impossible, if not impossible, to diagnose. Is that when it starts to act up more consistently or stops working whatsoever, is that makes it much easier or you're more successful at diagnosing it. So it's basically, in essence, like doing an autopsy on a person, is that once they pass away, then they can determine really what happened. But up until that particular point, it may be touch and go as far as having an accurate diagnosis. So intermittent problems, or gremlins in the industry, well, the layperson will call it gremlins, but we call them intermittent problems in the industry, is that are the most frustrating, and also they give you the highest level of insecurity. Because if you don't know whether you're going to go out in the field, or you're going to take the pickup truck to town, or your wife's car, or you're going to use the, whatever it may be, and you don't know whether it's going to act up, you don't know whether you shut it off, it's going to start, that you have no level of confidence of what is going to happen, is that that is very unnerving, and it is very polarizing. Because, I mean, I don't know if I should go out in the field. You know, is that sprayer pump going to kick in? I'm going to put, you know, thousands of dollars worth of product in this tank, but yeah, is that pump going to work? Is that solenoid going to go on? What am I going to do with it? You know, if the solenoid, if it doesn't work properly and I've got the tank, what am I going to do? Leave this thing in constant agitation for 2 days while I get a part for it? So the thing is that it brings a lot of baggage to it, and it brings a lot of stress. So, you know, something that's, hey, you know, you step on, you turn on the headlights, the bulb burned out, you have one headlight is out, you take the bulb out, you check for power, or you just throw another headlight in, it works, bingo, it's over with, it's gone. But if the headlight works intermittently, all right, then now we have an issue. Is it the connection? Is it the bulb itself? Is the filament coming loose in the bulb? Is it the switch? Is the switch worn and not making good contact and shutting it on and off? Is the ground wire loose? Is the ground wire bad? Did a mouse eat the ground wire? So who knows? So it brings a whole set of problems. But there is a proper procedure to try to identify these electrical gremlins. But this procedure, I will tell you, is often a collective approach of many different things, and it will bring you to that area if you execute it properly. Now, keep in mind that, as I said, that we are diagnosing determining what is good, and then through process of elimination, we'll see what is bad. So the thing is that, now, the bad thing about electricity, and we have done other shows on this, not about this topic per se, but the bad thing about electricity is you cannot see it. All right. If you could see water going in a hose, you could see hydraulic fluid, you could see that leaking on the ground. And with electricity, you can't really see that. The only time you could see that is if you have something that's called an unintentional ground, where you have a sheet metal screw go into metal, and then the thing burns up, and you see the smoke. So we call it letting the smoke out of the wire. All right. But the fact that matters, in most instances, you cannot see it. And then, with more of electronics today, on engine controls in agriculture, in-cab electronics, or what have you, is that it added a great level of complexity. So the thing is that, and you cannot see inside that monitor, you cannot see inside that 2020 seed sense unit, you cannot see inside that ECU running the engine on your combine, all right? So we need to determine externally what is good, and then if the external is not good, is good, then we know that the problem is inside, and that's when we replace it with a part. But I'm going to go through some things, and I'm going to jump around a little bit, because there is no rhyme or reason to it other than the foundation. And the foundation is that when you have an intermittent electrical issue, electrical gremlin on any piece of equipment and in any type of circuit. I don't care whether it's a monitor on a combine or whether it's the ECU on your pickup truck or your ATV or what have you, is that this procedures and the thought process is going to be the same. And the first thing that you need to do is you need to confirm power and ground. That's the most important, power and ground. That's the NP, and I'll say the K of growing a crop, power and ground. And confirming power and ground does not mean with a test light. A test light is a down and dirty way to say, man, is this wire hot? All right? Is this wire hot? And yes, I got some power there. But it does not tell you what is the quantity of the power. You can say, well, the test light looks pretty bright. Well, does it, you know, at 12 volts coming out of the battery, the test light is bright. Can you tell what a 10.5-volt test light bulb looks like? I can't. Well, if you can, you're like Thomas Edison, or better than he is. So the thing is that you need a test light to down and dirty. You could go there with a test light to a 12-volt circuit, 5-volt circuit, say, I got power, it's hot. But now we need to be able to go back with a voltmeter and confirm what that voltage is. And then on some circuits, what you may want to actually do is next time you're in town, buy, it doesn't have to be a halogen, buy either a single rectangular headlight or a round headlight and make up some jumper leads. And you could use a headlight to check a power and ground circuit. So if you have, let's say, a ground circuit for something, for ignition system, and you can't determine whether it's good or not, what you could do is you could use, you're not assigning a number with it with a headlight, but if the headlight could be bright, what you do is go across the battery first with your jumper leads from your ground, from your positive and your negative on the headlight, and you say, okay, ooh, the light's nice and bright. Then you go check that circuit. So in other words, if you wanted to check a ground circuit for something on a piece of equipment, all right, and you didn't want to do a voltage drop test for some reason, you're down and dirty, right, it's hard to get to, what you could basically do is run the power from the battery positive, take the ground from the headlight and attach it to the ground circuit, the ground wire that's unplugged from whatever it's from, a solenoid or something, and then touch it to it and see how bright the light is. If the light is not as bright as it was across the battery, is that you have a ground circuit issue. Because why do you have that? Because the light was bright with the power at the battery and the ground at the battery. The power stayed constant, it's still the battery, and now you're using a different ground. And what that is, what they call in electrical diagnostics, loading a ground circuit. Whereas I'm a big preacher and a big proponent of doing a voltage drop test on the ground, which we will discuss, and I've discussed previous shows, but I will bring it up again briefly, and that's a true quantifiable test. It gives you a quantity, it gives you a number. All right, this ground is 2/10 of an ohm, high impedance, on the verge of being high impedance, but the headlight puts a lot of load, and it's a good way to load a circuit. So the first thing basically is power and ground. Power means you assign a number with a voltmeter, and the next thing you do is you check the ground, preferably with a voltage drop test. If it's a very awkward wiring situation where you can't do a voltage drop test on it, then you'll spend about $5 to have the headlight and the jumper wires set up, and then you run power from a 12-volt source, and you check, and you light that light through that ground. That light should be as bright as it is across the battery. If it's not, then that ground is high impedance, all right? And now, keep in mind that a high impedance ground, especially with modern electronics, even with some older stuff, right, is that there's what is called in the circuit a threshold, and it's either a threshold voltage or a threshold to a resistance on the ground, but specifically, usually it's identified as a threshold voltage. So you may have a circuit that runs fine from 14.6 volts positive, which is basically the industry standard for a charging circuit, down to 11.7 volts. So that circuit could work fine with between 11.7 and 14.6 volts. You give that circuit 11.6 volts instead of 11.7, and now it may start to act a little bit funny. You give it 11.2 volts, it's going to act funnier. And the thing basically is that, and or it may still tolerate that. So the thing is that you have to keep in mind is that it's so important to check that voltage because of this threshold that is designed into every circuit. And with modern electronics, and you know, nobody really tells you. You buy something, you put all these electronics on a tractor and everything, nobody tells you what the threshold voltage is. Or very rarely do they do what the threshold voltage is. So the threshold voltage in your mind for every piece of equipment should be 14. What you do is you start the engine, you put the leads across the battery, you have the engine revved up a little bit. Okay, the system's putting out 14.82 volts. You may account for a tenth or two a voltage drop through the wiring harness. So you say, this every place I check for this intermittent problem, I have to have 14.6 volts with this engine running at 2,000 RPM. All right, so that's basically, so that becomes your threshold voltage. Anything below that, you say, oh, I got 13.9, becomes very suspicious, and you do not just say, oh, that's good enough, close enough for government work, and you need to pursue that at that particular circuit. So now, another thing that you need to do to identify electrical gremlins, intermittent problems, all right, is to do something that's called a tap and a wiggle test. And depending upon what the component is, what you're checking, the tap and wiggle test actually was initiated by Ford Motor Company, or brought to market by Ford Motor Company, and they named it that tap and wiggle test. And this goes for computer sensors, this goes for monitors, this goes for alternators, this goes for brake lights, it goes for anything electrical, all right? So I don't want to keep repeating it and waste time in the show, but if I happen to make a mention, say a computer sensor or an engine control sensor, don't think that it's only for that unless I say that, all right? So what you basically do is you get a good size screwdriver, all right? You get a good size screwdriver. You turn on whatever the thing may be. Let's say, for simplicity's sake, let's say it's a monitor, all right, in the cab of a combine, all right? So you get a good size screwdriver, and then you hold the screwdriver by the blade, and you take the handle and you wrap around that connection. You tap it, boom, 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 boom. You don't take it like a gorilla and try to bust the thing. But if you have a plastic or wooden handle screwdriver and it's not, you know, not meant to pry off a pipe from a oil well, then you're not going to hurt anything. You tap around there. You tap around the connection, because you may find that specifically with high-end electronics that the pin connections may not be making a good contact in there, and you go and you tap around things, right? If there's a control unit, an ECU, some sort of, people call it a brain, if it's a relay, if it's whatever it is, do the same thing. Do the tap test. Give it a good rap. And whatever that circuit is should be 100% benign. Benign. It should not know that you're tapping it whatsoever. All right? So if you tap that cable coming into that monitor, that power supply, using that as, you know, as we were talking about, and the monitor blinks for a second, does something funny, then that's indicative of a problem. So now you'll go down the field, you'll go down the road, you'll hit a certain bump or a certain type of frequency of bumps, all right? There's actually every movement inside a track or a vehicle could be assigned a frequency in hertz. Right, that's what I did. NVH, show on NVH, noise, vibration, harshness, is that it's assigned in engineering a frequency. As a farmer, I'm not going to assign a frequency what the bump is going over the ditch in the field, but the tap test will be able to simulate that. And then you do the same thing with a control unit. But with a control unit, you may want to first tap it with the screwdriver. But then what I like to do is that you'll take your hand or your fist, and you'll give it a good rap like that, a good rap. You give it a couple of good raps, all right? Then again, could be totally benign to you wrapping it, all right? You're not taking a sledgehammer, you're wrapping it with your hand. So tap test on connections, a tap test first, and then a hard wrap with your hand on some sort of ECU, control unit, cell, relay, what have you, a good wrap. All right, and then you may need a second person. You may be wrapping the control unit, and the person needs to be inside the cab and see if the monitor flashes. But as I said, benign, totally benign to it. So that's tap test. All right, and then the second test we're going to do is what's called the wiggle test, and we're going to have that circuit turned on. We'll stick with the monitor, and you're going to go around, and you're going to have somebody watch it, and you're going to take the wiring harness. You're not going to be a gorilla and rip it out, but you're going to take the wiring harness, and you're going to move it up and down, back and forth. You'll probably start at the connector and then move away from it. Now, I'm not saying rip the dashboard apart at this particular point, but try to move the wiring harness up and down, back and forth, all different ways, because you could have a loose connection. You could have an inquisitive mouse that got in there and started to chew away the insulation on one strand of a multi-strand wire is touching metal. All right, so the thing is that what you need to do is you're going to wiggle this harness up and down, back and forth, and you're going to use common sense. I mean, you're not going to go and rip the thing off, right? You're going to wiggle it. So the tap test and the wiggle test are very, very easy to, it's usually harder to get to the site to test than it is to do, and it's very, very, very effective in finding electrical gremlins intermittent problems. Another test that I like to do, and this applies to control units, and this applies to sensors. Sensors being engine control sensors, sensors on your planter, sensors on your combine, whatever it may be, a rotor sensor on a combine, maybe coming from the feeder house, who knows where it is, all right? Whatever, I'm not going to sit there and go through 10,000 different things. You get the idea. But control units, ECUs, control units, and sensors, all right? After we did the tap and the wiggle test, what we're going to do is we're going to do a heat soak and we're going to do a freeze test. And I'm sure that most people in their shop have a refrigerator freezer, all right? And some may each have a stove. You cannot use a microwave. I mean, you know, whatever. You know, this, you know, just obviously you know that, but I need to say it. And what you want to basically do is you want to take, let's say this is an ECU for an engine to start it. We'll use that. All right? And he said, man, this thing doesn't want to start in the cold weather. And you go crazy, we go crazy, and all of a sudden she starts, right? Or you come back an hour or two later, and all of a sudden she starts, and you're blaming a whole bunch of different things, all right? So what you want to do is you want to take that module, whether it's an ignition module, it's an ECU for the fuel injection system, and you want to put it in the freezer, right? Now, most freezers are between -2 to -10 or 20 below zero. That's 100% fine. So let's say arguably that you have a piece of equipment that gives you a hard time starting cold. All right, and you check, if it's diesel, you check the glow plugs, you check this, you check that, but whatever, and you've come to the point where it may be the ECU, electronic control unit, the brain of the system, all right? You did the tap test, you did the wiggle test, nothing comes up there, no problem, all right? What you do is take that, it's a hard starting cold problem, right? So what you do is you leave the piece of equipment in the shop overnight, you take the ECU out, or the module, whatever it may be, you take it and you put it in the freezer. All right, you come back the next, I mean, depending upon the procedure, I mean, you could come back in an hour or two, or leave it overnight, you're not going to hurt it, all right, you put it, you take it out, take your gloves, it's now -10, the ECU's -10, you run over to whatever, the truck or the tractor, or the snow plow, whatever you got there, you plug the ECU in, and you see whether you have the problem, whether it works. If it doesn't work, then we say, okay, fine, we got a handle on that issue. Now what you do is you let the ECU normalize to room temperature, since it's 60 degrees in your shop, and now you bring it either to your kitchen, and have your wife to look the other way, and or if you have a stove or a toaster oven in your shop or something like that, no microwave, obviously, all right, and you take the unit, and now you warm it up to about 120, 130 degrees. You want to warm it up to 120, 130 degrees. You get it to that temperature. You use an infrared gun to hit it. Doesn't have to be scientific. And now we're going to the exact opposite stream. Okay, it starts. It doesn't start. The system works. The sprayer works, whatever it may be. So what you're doing is you're using a refrigerator freezer and you're using an oven to simulate both hot and cold. And what will happen, and that's why also with the tap test, why the tap test is so important, is that lots of times you'll have a controller or you'll have a sensor that hasn't failed but has a weak or loose solder joint on the board. And the tap test, the wrap with your hand test, will shock that solder joint, all right? And then the thing is, and the same thing is, lots of times you'll find with cold or with heat that solder joint will either pull together or go away and open up more. So tap test, wiggle test, all right? Heat test, put the if it's a sensor, hey, let's say it's a crank position sensor on an engine, intermittent problem. All right, you did the tap, you did the wiggle test, fine. What you do is take the sensor out, put it in the freezer, right, -10 below zero, grab the sensor real quickly, I mean, as quick as you can, put it out there, put it into the engine, right, it's still going to be very cold, all right, it may not be -10 anymore because it's harder to put in, and then you go start the engine, no crank sensor signal, all right, fine, we know what the issue is. Same thing, heat, because remember, the two things that both electronics and machine we don't like is extreme hot and extreme cold. When it's 65, 70 degrees, 50 degrees, even 80 degrees, it's usually its sweet point. It's very, very happy. So those are two very, very valid tests. Of course, you nothing to do other than wrapping it with your hand, all right, or putting it in, wiggling a wire, or putting it in a refrigerator, or putting it in an oven. Another thing keep in mind, especially with advanced electronics, is noise on a circuit. Now, when I got engaged to my wife before I got married to my wife in 1999, we'll be having our 20th wedding anniversary this August 12th, I bought her a brand new car, a Ford Escort ZX2, red moonroof, very nice little car, and I brought it to her school. She's a kindergarten teacher, and I put it in the classroom with a big, I didn't get a bow, I couldn't find a big bow, I made a big cardboard sign with a heart and whatever, put it on the windshield, and I went inside, and I gave her the keys, and I left, and I went, I was actually doing test driving for BMW Engineering at that particular point. I had a contract, and I went from there up to there to do my work. But anyway, so we still have that car, and she uses that car around town, and she has a new Escape. But anyway, but the car, the ZX2, has been a great car, and has about 200,000 miles, a lot of local trips on it. And the thing is that intermittently, on a hot restart, she was getting a cam sensor code in it. And I went through the diagnostic routine, and I said, geez, you know, it was very hard for me to believe that it was so intermittent that the sensor code was going, that the sensor was going bad, because I could erase the code, and it was only on the hot restart. And people telling me, said, that the actuator is sticking. I said, I don't believe the actuator is sticking, because I always took great care of this engine. I don't believe that. I may be wrong. It may be sticking, but, you know, I mobile one it. The thing is, you took in the valve cover, the rocker, the overhead cam. The cam looks like brand new. The valve, the head looks like brand new. Everything looks like brand new. I said, I can't believe that it's gummed up and it's sticking, because the common problem with those would be a check engine light on restart, because the cam phaser is varnished and it can move the cam, advance or retard the cam. So I said, well, that may very well be. It may be weak, but I don't think it is, because it seems to me, it just doesn't seem to be, I don't know, I may be wrong, but my gut didn't tell me that. And on that particular engine, you got to rip the motor apart to put a cam sensor in it, a cam actuator, and you got to take the timing belt off, the gears off, the cams out of the head. So I wasn't anxious to do that without quantifying for sure that I thought it was it. So anyway, so to make a long story short, it was so intermittent, the issue. It was such a gremlin. It may not go for a week, and then two starts in a day, it'll do it and what have you. But it was always on a hot restart. It was always after a heat soak. It was never when it was cool or cold. So I was giving it some thought, and I said to myself, now, I wasn't able to quantify this, all right? I will say that, but it was an educated guess. I said, you know, these ignition wires are 18 years old. The car runs fine. It runs beautifully, all right? The car runs fine. I mean, I could, 6,700 RPM, bang, fangs and shifts if I whack it. I mean, screams and everything. And you say, well, how could the ignition wire, 6,700 RPM, it's not, it's doing everything perfectly. Well, the cam sensor wires run near the number one ignition wire. And I said to myself, you know, this insulation is probably starting to break down. It's having some EMI. I said, I'm sure it's having some EMI, electromotive interference, which is noise leakage from it. It's not, it's firing the plugs fine, all right, but it's probably noisy. It's probably like a noisy bearing, right? It's still working fine, but it's making noise. So that's an EMI in electronics is what that is. It's like a noisy bearing. It's still turning, but it's got noise to it instead of being smooth. So I said, I don't believe it's a cam sensor at this particular point. I'm going to put new wires on when I have the wires that I'll throw new plugs in. Just because this way I go in there one time, I'm done with it for the next 20 years, right? But anyway, and that's what it was. The wires were heat soaking. The insulation looked fine. It wasn't burned through, but they were old. The wires were old, and they were leaking. All right, they were leaking, and they were only leaking on the hot restart. They were leaking enough to cause what we call electrical noise on a circuit, which is layperson's time we would say static. All right? And a computer circuit, a sensor circuit, is very sensitive to that for two reasons. Number one, it's a low voltage, 0 to 5 volt signal, and the wires that run to it are very thin and do not have a lot of insulation. And so they're very prone to being attacked by EMI. And, you know, as an aside, in the military, they talk about Please forgive me, I forgot what it's called. It's one of those bombs that wipe out all electronics. Nothing happens to anybody, nobody dies, but it wipes out all the electronics. Well, that's what was happening, is that the ignition wires on the ZX2 engine were old enough that they were leaking, ran the motor full voltage to the spark plugs, no problem, ran up to 6,700, banged the shifts beautifully, 1-2, if the ground was a little bit cool, it would chirp the tires, all right, but the thing is that they were leaking on the hot restart because the underhood temperature on a re-soak, on a heat soak goes very high, and the wire, the insulation was breaking down, leaking, and then it would set the code. So keep in mind that noise, electrical noise, will definitely impact and affect and create an electrical gremlin in a low voltage, a monitor, a sensor, any type of sensor or equipment like that, or thing, high end or electronics that you have on your farm equipment. So that's something. So how do you isolate this? The best way to determine it is to have an oscilloscope, which we will eventually do a show on, have an oscilloscope and be able to see the signal, because a voltmeter doesn't tell you, it just tells you what the high and the low was. It doesn't show you what the signal was. It's not like a tissue analysis. It just basically tells you the plant is yellow. You don't know why, all right? But electrical noise, and what you could basically do is that, so if you have an electrical problem with something that's intermittent, right, that you need to try to qualify and come and say, geez, you know, this has happened when I have the headlights on. It's happened when I have the air conditioner, more electrical load on the system, right? So one of the things that you could do, depending upon, you have to look at where the wires to that particular circuit go. If it's running near the alternator, what you may want to do is unplug the field circuit from the alternator. That's the little plug that goes into an alternator. It's not the heavy lead that goes to the battery, all right? It's the field circuit, the low voltage. Unplug the field circuit. By unplugging the field circuit, what you will basically do is you will shut the alternator off. It'll spin, but it'll have no output. And if it has no output, it cannot make any electrical noise. Now, you could have an alternator that is in the case of the ZX2, the noise was infiltrating into the wire, but you could have an alternator that is creating a dirty signal, dirty electricity, all right? It has a diode that is starting to fail, and it could be creating a dirty signal, and that dirty signal is going and messing up your monitor, messing up your ECU, messing up your sensors. So one of the tests to do is when, after you've done some other things and you looked around and you say, well, geez, let's unplug this field circuit and let's start this engine and see if this monitor is doing this, see if this sets this trouble code or whatever, all right? Because you may be sending a dirty signal out, and then the advanced electronics, a headlight is not going to care about a dirty signal. You would never know it, all right? A light bulb is not going to care about it. To tell you the truth, most of the time, even a solenoid is not going to care about a dirty signal. But a monitor would care about a dirty signal. A computer sensor would care about a dirty signal. Auto steer would care about a dirty signal. All of those things would care about a dirty signal and would impact it. So the thing is that you want to unplug it, and then you may want to run the engine. You may want at that particular point even put a battery charger on it with the alternator unplugged, all right, and see whether that problem goes away. So intermittent. Oftentimes what you will find is that signal will become dirtier coming out of that alternator if it has a weak diode when you load the electrical system. So you run it at night, you're planting at night, right? You got the headlights on, all right? You got the headlights on, and then the thing basically is that it's right at the threshold of that diode passing current both ways and making that signal dirty, all right? So keep that in mind, all right? So you want to disconnect it and take that, you just unplug the field circuit. Unplug the field circuit, that alternator will become benign. It'll be spinning. It'll have no output. The charge circuit light will go on. Forget about that. Who cares? What you want to try to do is quantify whether the signal being dirty is impacting what your issue, creating whatever your issue is. Other thing, like I said, grounds. Grounds are extremely important. A voltage drop test on the ground, the way you do a voltage drop test is you go to the ground circuit with the positive lead of the voltmeter. You go with the negative lead of the voltmeter to the negative side of the battery. You power up that circuit and you read the traffic jam of electrons that can't get to ground. It should be between, it should be less than 0.2 of a volt. As I always say, it's like cows coming out of a barn. If there's a narrow gate, right, the traffic jam all backs up. You're counting how many cows are waiting to come out of the barn. That's what a voltage drop test is. If you can't do that for some reason, you're by yourself or whatever, it's too awkward, then what you could basically do is go to that ground and remember, you say, some guy might say, I don't care, I just look at it. If it looks clean, I know it's good. Well, you don't know what's good, all right? Right, because cleanliness is only one indicator. The plant, the corn looks green, right? The corn looks good. There's no nutrient deficiencies until you go through it with the combine and see that you're down 40 bushels per acre. But sure looked green when I was riding by at 50 miles an hour. So anyway, is that what you could do, and you know, there's no, you want to identify where the circuit is, what the problem is, all right? As long as you get there, that's fine. You ain't get the 300 bushels per acre. However you get there, that's fine, right? So the thing is that what you want to do is you want to run an external ground. Run an external ground to something. See if it gets better. Right? Think out of the box. So basically, to put closure to this, electrical gremlins are going to determine what is good, not necessarily what is bad. If everything coming into the unit is good, everything coming into the monitor, the ECU, the controller, the solenoid, the sensor is good, all right, and then the problem is still there, then it is that apparatus. It's that ECU, it's that monitor, it's that relay, what have you. So real quick before we get into special delivery, is that intermittent problems, try to pay attention. Do they happen with the headlights on, air conditioners? Is it more prone, hot, cold, what have you, all right? That you want to do a tap wiggle test. You want to wiggle a harness tap. You want to do a tap test on a more massive unit with your hand. Boom, you want to hit it. There should be no effect whatsoever. Tap and wiggle test. You want to take the unit, heat it in the stove to about 130, 140, 150 degrees. You probably don't want to go much more than that, all right? And then you want to also put it in the freezer, all right? You want to put it in right away. See if the problem comes up. You want to check your ground circuits, all right? You want to think of noise, electrical noise. You may take the wire and you may move it away from something, all right? So if it's running near a spark plug, move it away from there and see if this problem gets better. If you really want to go into diagnostics, you could wrap that wire with aluminum foil, take alligator clips with thin jumper wires and run it to ground, because the EMI, from the voltage source, would actually take the ground path, because it goes to the path of least resistance, through the aluminum foil, the alligator clips, instead of going into the insulation. But be cognizant of noise. There's no set thing that you look at, but be cognizant of noise on a circuit and try to isolate. Sometimes you're just moving the wires, all right? Moving the wires around. All right, we want to do that, and we want to disconnect our alternator, and we want to look at the whole system collectively in a voltage drop test on the ground. If you can't get to it, run another ground wire and see if the problem gets better. Intermittent gremlins, intermittent problems are always a frustration when they're a challenge, but when you're trying to run a farm or a dairy operation or whatever, you're not up for challenges, all right? This is not like it's a troubleshooting contest or what have you. You want to try to get that piece of equipment up and running as quickly as possible. You want to get it up and running. You don't want to spend a lot of money throwing parts at it, unnecessarily parts, and you want to get back into what your business is, and that is farming. So if you have any questions, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And now we're to our special delivery section, and I am proud as could be to tell you that it is brought to you by Firestone Ag, a company that's founded by Harvey Firestone, a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey always dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar design, AD2 technology. Those are IF and VF tires, great products, even for your grain carts, and now the Firestone of replacement tracks. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. No, we have a little bit of a different letter today, and it says, this is from Ron in Oklahoma, and says, "Hi, I am a row crop farmer and a car guy. For years, I have enjoyed you in the car magazines, in Successful Farming magazine, and on Successful Farming TV, and now your podcast website, and I also love the toolbox test. It's great." So, listen, Ron, I want to thank you so much, because you're basically consuming everything I produce, and it's actually humbling to think that, someone is actually, you know, enjoying all of those from this dryland farmer. So I want to thank you so much for that, and for just reading and listening to all of those things. My question to you is, what is the most powerful engine you have ever worked on or built? Thanks for the education, Ron. Well, Ron, the most powerful gasoline engine that I ever built was probably, well, it's hard for me to say, different. Well, to answer your question succinctly, all right, I built an 850 horsepower supercharged LT1 for a Camaro. That engine probably would have made 1,100 horsepower. It had a Vortex supercharger on it. But when we dynoed it in a digital fuel injection in Wixom, Michigan, basically I had a small cam in it, so it ran out of RPM at about, I think it was about 20 years ago, 5,900 RPM, and peaked, about 5,000 RPM. So anyway, peak torque was only 1,000 RPM below peak horsepower. On a well-defined engine, you want peak torque to be 1,500 to 2,000 RPM above peak horsepower. So that means that that engine just was running out of cam and could not breathe anymore past that. That probably would have been a 950 horsepower piece to 1,000 horsepower instead of an 800, I think it was an 800, 8.25 piece. I think we let it go out the door like at 750 and put a safety margin in it. I was involved with tuning. I did not build a Buick Grand National engine, twin turbo, Indy block, Indy cylinder heads, individual runner intake manifold, and that made about 1,500 horsepower on the dyno. I was involved with an engine project for Drag Racer magazine, and it was a conventional head, big block Chevy. Was a, I don't remember. It was a 468 or 496. It was under 500 cubic inches, and that was a conventional cylinder head with a cast aluminum single four-barrel carburetor, and on VPQ16. VPQ16 is quick burn 116 octane fuel. That thing made, I think, 1,068 horsepower. So basically, in essence, keep in mind, I've been out of this for like 20 years now, 23 years, as far as building engines, and I got into doing engineering testing and writing for magazines and what have you, and doing seminars. But I would say, just give or take around 1,000 horsepower piece was, other than that Buick, but was more or less what I was able to accomplish. And today, that's like somebody saying, "Man, I got 160 bushels per acre corn. 1,000 horsepower piece is nothing today." I mean, 1,000 horsepower piece is like 180 bushel corn today. That's not getting into the high yield. But you could buy a crate motor from Chrysler, that Helifen, which is a supercharged Hemi, that's 1,000 horsepower. And my buddy Bob Ida has his Bonneville Salt Flats truck, 4.6-liter twin-turbocharged Illuminator Ford in an F-150, and that thing made 1,200 at the tires. That's like 1,500 at the crank. But I'm a 1,000 horsepower man, and I really haven't had any exposure to build anything beyond that or to tune anything beyond that. But listen, thanks so much for the question. Thanks so much for reading and for listening and for watching. That's great, and I am humbled. I mean that sincerely, that you're consuming all of my, this kid from Cat Swamp Roads, whatever, babblings. So listen, thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show this week. I enjoyed delivering it to you, and please know that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved, beloved America. You have a blessed day, and please check in next week. Bye-bye.